Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Melody Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. My co-host, Alfred Adisk, and James Corbett of the Corbett Report will join you for the remainder of the program following the first break in approximately 20 minutes, as we do each and every Thursday. And today is April 7th, 2016. Once again, welcome to the program, and thank you for joining me for my 20 minutes of fame here on Thursday afternoon. Gold had a great day today. It was up strong, stayed strong. That's what I'd like to see. And, you know, there might be a few reasons. There was a weaker U.S. dollar index today. It hit nearly an eight-month low. Plus, there's more concerns that the U.K. might exit from the European Union and put a little pressure on the euro. However, the euro was stronger today, so I'm not sure if you know, if that was the main culprit, or I shouldn't say culprit, but the main impact for the rising gold, or a referendum in the Netherlands, the European Union-Ukraine trade, those relations failed. So were people seeking a safe haven due to those reasons? I don't know. Gold is just strictly way underpriced. But what I do see as safe haven buying is those 10-year yields. And, you know, those are, we'll have to see what they've done for the day. But I know you're all waiting to see what gold has done. Gold up $18.70 today, $18.70. At 1242. They've had some nice swings, you know, $20 plus here in the last few weeks, and gold is certainly having a great year for gold. Silver is up 15 at 1532. Platinum was up 10 at 959. Palladium had a rough day, down 4 at $540. The USDX, it's showing it's reversing. It was down most of the day. It's up a little bit, 0.03 at 94.53. But we have seen pressure on the dollar since it hit that, just about hit that 100 point, or did hit that 100 point. Crude oil down 31 at 37.44. And the paper markets today, finally the Dow followed the European markets, but, you know, it was down most of the day, over 1%, 174 points down, 17,541. The NASDAQ was down 1.5%. It's down 72 at 48,48. The S&P down 24 at 2,041. And, yeah, the 10-year yield, 1.69. When you see that yield drop that like that, you see that you know, it's a sign that people are buying bonds. They're seeking bonds as a safe haven. And You know, I think that's the story there in the 10-year yield. That 1.69%, I think, is incredible. I don't hear anybody talking about it, but I certainly believe that is an important number right there. And in relationship to the gold prices, as much as that has fallen, gold is way, way still underpriced. I mean, we know that. I mean, we're expecting 3,000 and 5,000 golds, and some predict higher. So certainly we're at, you know, we have a long way to go. But buy low, folks. This is still really low prices. And if we expect 5,000 gold, even gold at 2,500 is going to be low. So don't keep the price of gold and silver as they continue to move up a reason to keep you out of the gold and silver market. Because as they climb and things continue to get worse, they're not going to correct. And I don't believe that many of you think that gold will go to 700, as I don't. But so we had a good day today in gold. We'll rejoice, and we'll see how it ends the week tomorrow. So there's a report out today. Jen Dodaro. He's the Comptroller General for the Government Accountability Office, the GAO. He testified at the Senate Budget Committee, and he provided the results of its audit on the government's financial books. Now, there's a lot that he said that we're not really surprised. He says we're heavily leveraged in debt. Well, that's no big surprise. He talks about the historical average post-World War II of how much debt we held as a percentage of GDP. That was 43% on average. Right now, we're about 74%. And of course, we're not talking about the whole of the amount of unfunded liabilities. These based on the government's audit, the numbers that they provide. The highest in the U.S. Government's history of debt held by the public as a percent of gross domestic product was 1946, right after the war. He says we're on mark to hit that and go way above that. He says there are projections to go to 200 to 300% and even higher of debt held by the public as a percent of gross domestic product. We talked about this just earlier this week, but we're probably already there. They're just not accounting for it. We're going to owe more than our entire economy is producing. And by definition, this is not sustainable. And where do you think your stock market's going to be? And where do you think the rest of your investments and your retirement funds and your retirement accounts and your IRAs, where do you think they're going to be if we owe more than our entire economy is producing and it is not sustainable? None of this surprises me. We talk about it on the program. It's not a shock. It's confirmation. And it's confirmation that the government is coming out, that the auditor is coming out and saying, hey, we're in trouble. But there's more to his testimony. The audit found fault with a number of improper payments that should not have been made or were the incorrect amount. The audit found that in fiscal year 2015, there were $136.7 billion of improper payments. And hey, it was up by $12 billion from the year prior. So, you know, what's $12 billion among friends from last year in the government? You know, the audit called into question the consistency of their financial statements, of the government's financial statements. I mean, we question this all the time, and yet this isn't surprising news. It's just, it dumbfounds me sometimes to see that this is maybe $12 billion in increase over a year is not much. Maybe $136.7 billion of improper payments. Maybe that's not a lot to a lot of people. But to me, it's just another sign. It's a 2x4 that's flying through the air that's telling us that, hey, the government has severe problems. No wonder they don't want Donald Trump in there to try and fix anything. Like I said, we might get Donald Trump in there to fix things, or he'll try to fix things. But what's going to happen in the meantime? It's not going to make your investments in paper any safer. He won't be friendly to Wall Street. And he even said it would be nice to have a currency our money backed by gold. But he said it's not realistic. But that's the only thing that's really going to take us out of these problems that we have. So the report found that this was not always the case and found hundreds of billions of dollars in differences between transactions between federal entities. The GAO audit tells us what came into the government's coffers and what went out, what the government owes and what it, what the government owns and what it owes, and if the operations are financially sustainable. Well, they're not. But what's interesting about this is that this guy who testified, he says this audit calls into question the reliability of the underlying financial data or data. The sketchiness is such that the GAO remains unable to even issue an audit opinion on the government's books. Well, I can give you an audit opinion. I mean, it tells us what we tell you every day, that we have so much debt that they can't even track it, that they can't, and the books are so poorly, I mean, $136 billion that they can't improper payments or were incorrect amounts. I mean, a two-year-old can keep better books than that. So, I mean, it's just amazing that they can't even produce an opinion. And according to the audit, these weaknesses will eventually harm the government's ability, no kidding, to report their assets, liabilities, and costs. And this will prevent the government from having the information to operate in an efficient and effective manner. Well, did you ever know our government to work or to operate in an efficient and effective manner? No. There's another report that just confirms how the government cannot work in an effective and efficient manner. And we've talked about this before, is the student loans, the loan program. More than 40% of Americans who borrowed from the government's main student loan program aren't making payments or are behind on more than $200 billion owed, raising worries. Millions of them may never repay. There's $1.2 trillion in student loans that's owed to the education department. Well, there's another 43% of roughly 22 million Americans who weren't making payments. You know, there's a few more million here that were in default on $56 billion in student debt. There's a few more million who owe roughly $66 billion that were at least a month behind. In the meantime, there's another 3 million owing almost $110 billion that were in deferment, meaning they had received permission to temporarily halt payments due to a financial emergency, like unemployment. So if you add up all of these billions of dollars, you know, that were at least a month behind, are in default and so forth, you're looking at almost half of the $1.2 trillion that the government has loaned out to these kids. That's almost half of the $1.1 trillion that's in trouble. And the Obama administration, he worried. Funny if they, you know, Obama really worried about these kids qualifying for loans. He's worried about the taxpayer costs, which I don't believe that. I don't think there's anybody in Washington that is concerned about taxpayer costs and the prospects of consumers damaging their credit by defaulting. And I don't think Obama and Washington is really concerned about that either. But what's interesting is here you have another arm of the government who loans out $1.2 trillion. And they don't even bother to see if anyone can pay it back. If they do virtually no credit checks on borrowers, they require no co-signers, they don't screen people for their preparedness for college-level coursework. So what planet does a financing vehicle with those kinds of terms would make those kinds of loans? That's another government program that is That is a failure. Oh, and don't forget subprime loans. What about Fannie and Freddie? Again, so, you know, when we talk about all our programs that the government has created, there has yet been one they didn't touch or they didn't screw up. And the taxpayer, you and I, we get to pay for it. Now, something else I want to talk to you about on Thursdays, I might do this every week. If I run over time, I'm scheduled to hold back on the break just so I can finish my thoughts and get this in real quick. It's kind of like a Gold Course 101. Early this week, we talked about financial analysts who only recommend 5 to 10% in gold. Many of these guys have great information. I just don't agree with their asset allocations, and I would debate any of them, and I would probably win. We mentioned brokers. They don't make money on selling gold. They can't trade you. They make more money on paper investments than they do on the commission of gold. I am not a financial planner, but I've been doing this for over 21 years. I'm here to give you some insights on why gold is important. You know, we stray that, you know, we either buy gold because it's going to rise. We're going to buy silver because there's a shortage and it's going up to, you know, $500. We strayed from the fundamentals. I'm going to hopefully give you some insights on how to diversify your portfolio of gold and silver. It should make some common sense to you. We want to buy low, sell high. What is suitable for your precious metals acquisitions? These are important strategies when you're deciding on how you want to allocate your precious metals investments. And I'm not going to do all this today. We're going to take a little bit at a time. And I don't do these programs just to hang out. I mean, my goal is to help you to truly understand the gold market and the fundamentals, because the fundamentals is going to keep you from falling into traps like gold is going to 700, or traps to store your metals in Switzerland, or traps to own gold shares versus real gold. You know, you have to be informed so you can make a good decision when you're working with your money, and people are confused. You don't know what to do. You hear so many different things, and this is the first time in your life, particularly people who are getting ready to retire or close to retirement. They never thought they'd have problems. They never thought they'd have to handle their money. They never thought that they'd have to look at our financial system ready to collapse with so much debt that will never be paid. That now they have to make decisions on what are they going to do. You can't make decisions unless you're informed. And when you just follow certain people and their views and the way they analyze for their agenda, it doesn't help you. So we're here to help you understand why gold isn't an important part of your paper investments and why you must be properly insured. You should insure your wealth. If an insurance agent came to you and said, hey, we have a policy that's going to protect you against the falling stock market, I bet everyone that is listening that has paper investments would buy the insurance policy. So why wouldn't you have gold? Why wouldn't you have the ultimate insurance policy to protect your wealth? It's not unreasonable to expect further disruptions in our financial markets. We talk about it every day in banking, in our economy. Good Lord, just sharing with you about the government audit alone should scare anyone with wealth that they could lose. We have wars, rumors of wars. Investors, when these things happen, everyone will gravitate towards gold and silver. Precious metals have always been and likely will continue to be a valued form of wealth insurance in good times and bad, a real source of money. Between 2001 and 2011, the price of gold increased over 600% in about 10 and a half years. Silver, 1,100% in just 9.5 years. These are just two examples of the long-term profit potential possible in the precious metals markets. But what's important is during these increases, your paper investments were very volatile, and gold and silver provided you the insurance to offset that volatility. And when you diversify, you are spreading money among different investments to reduce risk. The object is to limit your losses and reduce the fluctuations of investment returns. So how does 5% reduce your risk? Diversification isn't about capturing bigger gains. Diversification is limiting your losses. It's not about gains. It's limiting your losses. The rise in gold and silver is the gravy. The higher the price goes, that's just gravy while you're limiting your losses. It's just not about the $5,000 gold. It's just not about silver being 100. It's just not about gold and silver and bartering. It is about ensuring your wealth, the fundamentals, protecting your wealth, protecting your purchasing power, providing you with an independence and privacy paper vestments do not provide. Gold is money. Gold will always be money. There's no substitute, no debt claim against gold. Gold does not depend on the ability of someone else to pay, like stocks and bonds. These are the promises to pay that Al talks about. When bad things happen, you will rely on gold and silver. And bad things, unfortunately, are going to happen. And we have to remember, gold is money. You're converting your paper currency to real money. Personally, I don't know why anyone would risk what they work so hard for. We know what is going to happen. The system is going to purge and people are going to be wiped out. And it isn't going to come back like it has done since 2010. If you believe a collapse is right around the corner, well, then you know what to do. If you don't think we're going to have any problems, if you think we're going to go to 20,000, 25,000 the Dow and the government is going to be able to pull rabbits out of their hat every day, well, then maybe 5% is all you really need in gold and silver. But I don't think that's what's going to happen. What you don't want is to be afraid of doing something to protect your wealth. You should be afraid of doing nothing. And if you don't understand something, call me. We will help you to understand. Call us, 800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. The Mint State 61 coins are available. We did have to increase their price. They're now going at $1,345. And again, that's still a little less than $40 over an American Gold Eagle. An incredible steal. Get it while you can. Now that I'm over break, Frank, thank you for holding that break for me, and you guys will continue with Al and James Corbett.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Adisk, and our guest is James Corbett from the Corbett Report. James will be speaking to us from Japan, where it's morning, and here it is kind of late night where I am in Dallas, Texas. And hello, James, how are you doing?
Doing pretty well. How are you doing today, Al?
Good. I can't complain. I wish I could. I wish I could get some complaints in there, but I can't. How are things going in Japan? If I understand correctly, they may have decided that they're about out of economic tricks. Have they decided that quantitative easing isn't going to work? Isn't going to be attempted any further? Has that decision been made, or is that just a fantasy in my mind?
Well, I don't think that that has been officially admitted, but I think that's what everyone's starting to understand now. Certainly, it doesn't look like negative interest rates have had whatever effect they were intending it to have. And, in terms of quantitative easing, from what I understand, the BOJ is more likely to look at more easing now than further cutting. So those are pretty much their only options. They've been doing easing for years now.
When you say further cutting, you're talking about interest rates?
Cutting interest rates, yeah. Sorry. Okay. So making them further negative. I don't think anyone is really expecting them to cut further into negative interest rate territory. But there is, assuming they do anything, it's most likely to be easing.
Is there any probability that they are going to raise interest rates? Abandon negative interest rates at this time?
Yeah, no, I don't see how they could possibly do that at this point.
They painted themselves into a corner?
They really have. Again, yes, exactly right. Because, of course, the whole point of cutting rates is supposedly to get things moving again, get inflation going, and then you can start to raise rates as the economy is picking up and hope that it doesn't derail the recovery. But even as the Federal Reserve is finding out, I mean, obviously that's extremely difficult to do. And they said that the Fed said they were going to do 4 interest rate raises this year, and then that got chopped down to, well, maybe 2. And now it's, well, maybe 1, maybe 0. So I think, and again, that's exactly what people like Peter Schiff and others were saying. They're going to do one rate hike and that's it, and they're going to have to cut again eventually.
Are they caught in a situation that they can't extricate themselves from, at least not gracefully, without repudiating fundamental ideas that they've been operating on for decades? And what I'm talking about specifically is fiat currency. Is fiat currency such an irrational concept that it eventually drives you to a point where once you accept that as a premise, you've got to do some very strange things, including negative interest?
Well, I think you're right to gesture at the underlying problem here is the monetary system itself, but they are not, I guarantee you, they're not going to come out and admit that. They're going to look for ways that they can further tinker with the system. And I think this is, I mean, ultimately, whether it's planned this way or whether it's just happening this way, it doesn't even make a difference, but they're going to fail forward with it. And that's going to mean further coordination between central banks, like what we saw in the G20 directly after Lehman Brothers. There was the G20 in London in 2009, and that was where they started. They made the first ever coordinated interest rate cut across central banks. I can't remember how many of them participated, but a number of central banks all cut at the same time as part of an agreement. It was the first time that had been coordinated on an international level. You saw the increasing importance of the Financial Stability Board, the FSB, which is a subgroup of the BIS, the Bank for International Settlements, that was created before that point, but really started to gain some momentum and gain some legs and gain a bit of teeth in the wake of that. And they're the ones coming up with these bail-in rules that are now, as you see, are now being explicitly put in the Canadian budget that was just released earlier this month or last month. So all of this is now being coordinated at a much greater international scale. And I think when and if and as the central banks start showing their ineptitude and we start seeing the effects of the last several years of bubble starting to evaporate and or pop, I think they're just going to fail forward and say, we need more international coordination, more power. And we're going to have to start looking at the idea of, well, obviously, yes, these individual fiat currencies are unstable, so we're going to have to coordinate them somehow, put them in a basket, start a new system. And I think that's what they're going to try to do. But you're right. The fundamental problem is the monetary system, the debt-based fiat system, and they're never going to admit that.
Well, they all fail. It appears that virtually all fiat monetary systems fail. I've seen reports. One analysis said there were something like 275 fiat currencies in the history of the world, and virtually all of them had blown up, with the exception of three, four of them that are still around at the moment, including the U.S. dollar. But they're only good typically for a couple of generations, and then they're gone, which implies we're going to see that moment. No matter what the banks do, we're going to come on that moment when the currency fails. What's going to happen then?
I wish I could tell you definitively. All I know is that I think that the original setup for what was the basis for the current international monetary order was Bretton Woods, 1944. They started to set it up, and that functioned. That actually functioned the way it was intended to function, or the way they thought it was going to function, for two decades at best. By the 1960s, it was already falling apart. And then, of course, as we know, in 71, Nixon took the dollar off the gold standard and officially ended the system as it was then. And since that time, we've been working with these floating interest rates. There's really, at this point, not even the idea that there's anything backing up the system. That's been functioning for four decades on spit, bubblegum, and, you know, hope and prayer. And we are starting to see that system breaking down. So I think you're right. We are living through the transitional phase right now. What will replace it, it truly is going to be contingent on the types of solutions that they're going to offer us, unless we take the initiative and create our own workarounds. And that's why I'm always stressing that anything and everything we can use to create systems, because it's more about the systems and the infrastructure we create for trading with each other around their system is the important part of it. It's not even what you trade in that I think is the most important bit. Gold, silver, cryptocurrency, alternative currency, community currency, barter. Absolutely any one of them is preferable, and preferably all of them would be preferable. But again, unless we start building this up, they're going to come along with a new solution, quote unquote, which is just going to be more of the medicine that that made us sick in the first place.
He talks about central bank coordination and that the 2009 marked something of a remarkable step forward in terms of central bank coordination, and now we're perhaps seeing evidence of it again. Are the central banks, are they mostly inclined to work together? Are they all on the same page, essentially, or is there significant competition among them?
Well, there is the idea of the currency war, the race to the bottom, the let's make our currency as cheap as possible so that we can get engaged in global trade as much as possible. Certainly for the export-dependent nations, that's an important strategy. And that creates tensions between neighbors and between different central banks that in the past, like in the 1930s, did lead to a real slowdown in global trade and ultimately helped to precipitate World War II. But yes, I mean, I think we're living through that system right now. And I think that we're starting to see some of that international coordination that we were seeing back in the 1930s in terms of competition. I think we're seeing the exact same type of thing playing out. And that's worrying because, as we've seen in the past, it leads to real military conflict. Now, I think there is a deeper level beneath that, beyond that, above that, however you want to phrase that, where, yes, those central banks at that level are in competition, but I think that the real coordinating power that we're talking about when we start talking about international coordination and the Bank for International Settlements, I think over and above those national interests, they're looking at the international system, and there's a sense in which those currency wars and the competition can be used to actually create the sense of crisis that is needed for that deeper level of integration. And I think that's kind of a second level of the system that's playing out at the same time. So people like Haruhiko Kuroda, the central bank governor of the Bank of Japan, and the People's Bank of China, and Yellen at the Fed, and over at the ECB, what's his name, Draghi, I think they are, in a sense, in competition, but I think that the real coordination that goes on at the BIS is over and above and beyond what they are doing. And they may just be, in a sense, if not pawns, at least not quite the king and queen on the chessboard table.
What do you think the chances are that a new world order, a single world government, is likely to emerge? If there's any competition between the central banks, seems to me they've all got to get on the same page if there's going to be a new world order. And if there's any competition between them, antagonism, whatever, I don't see that the new world order as a single global government is likely to emerge right anytime soon.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And I think we are still a way away from that. We're not quite at the doorstep it's going to happen any day now, because I think there are still too many people who are invested in, if not national interests, at least more localized interests or personal interests, and that do have genuine squabbles. I don't think it is, one room full of people that meet and, uh-huh, they decide everything that happens in the earth. I think there are factions and cliques, and there are genuine power interests that are struggling for control. And of course, while that is still happening, then the global government is not going to really materialize. But I think that the real stepping stone towards the consolidated global government is the squabbling regional factions and a growing sense of regional identity, which will create the blocks that become the global system of the future. And that global system, I don't know, I think eventually, I think they do want one global government over everything, but I think it can form from the regional squabbles. And I think that's what we're starting to see. We're starting to get the sense of Europe as a block, whereas even a few decades ago, thinking of it as a total economic block would have been kind of silly. Oh, you know, Italy and Germany and England, they don't have anything to do with each other. But now we have this sense of Europe as a bloc. We have this sense of East Asia as a bloc. We have the sense of Central Asia, Eurasia. It is starting to materialize in that fashion. And that's the logical stepping stone. And once we start to get more regional integration and, you know, some sort of North American sense that North America is competing against the Asian bloc. I mean, it does start to devolve into that 1984 world, but that's the obvious stepping stone towards the global government of the future.
One of the things I've wondered about over the years, I witnessed this at least 10, 15 years ago, where Japan was at one point on the business cycle, and the United States was at a different point. One of them was essentially at a peak on the business cycle, and the other one was at a valley. And when Japan might sit back and say, we want low interest rates so people can borrow more money and stimulate the economy, at the same time, the United States was sitting back and saying, we need high interest rates in order to slow the economy down. Now, the problem was that when Japan had low interest rates, and the United States had high interest rates, the Japanese were taking their money, was fleeing from Japan. The creditors were saying, I'm not going to lend my money out for nothing. I'll move my money into the United States. And the net result is the United States, by raising interest rates, they actually attracted capital out of Japan, which tended to stimulate the U.S. economy. They're raising interest rates in order to slow the economy down, and it actually attracted foreign capital and caused the economy to speed up. At the same time, the Japanese are trying to lower interest rates to make it easy to borrow, and what they did was drive currency out of the country, so there was less currency for the Japanese people to borrow. And what I'm trying to get, where I'm going with this, is in order to have a new world order and a world government, they've got to get everybody running at the same point on the business cycle. All right? Japan's got to hit that low point where they want low interest rates at the same time the United States wants low interest rates, at the same time China wants low interest rates. Everybody's got to have a desire for low interest rates or high interest rates at the same time. As soon as we start, one country wants high, the other one wants low, things happen that just take the monetary system out of the control of the powers that be. Do you follow what I'm saying, and does it make any sense to you?
Yes, it does. And I think the obvious example of that right now is the European Union, where you have this European Central Bank that, for the Eurozone anyway, for the Eurozone countries, is determining the interest rates, the value of the money itself throughout the whole Eurozone. And within the Eurozone itself, you have different countries that obviously desire different rates, different levels that would like either more currency or less. You're exactly right.
How do we get them all in sync?
Well, actually, and another layer on top of that is that we're seeing a similar situation to the one you were describing between the U.S. and Japan. We're seeing part of that right now when the Fed hiked rates last December. And in preparation for that hike, which everyone knew was coming, we started to see all that money flowing back from the emerging markets where it had been invested trying to find a little bit of return coming back into the U.S. and strengthening the dollar, which is creating things like the commodities route that we're seeing. So, yes, there are layers and layers of things that are going on here. I think the thing that I would say to that is that there is the sense in which you can have a global system that is globally controlled by playing regions off of each other. And it's not the type of global control where it's one dictator that dictates everything to everyone, so much as the idea that, okay, this region can be allowed to grow at this point, and this region we're going to put through some, you know, economic hardship, and then maybe flip the tables later on. It's like that idea of the 1984 universe where you have Eurasia and Central East Asia and whatever. And the question, which is there in the 1984 universe, is, I mean, A, are they really at war at all? Are these bombs even happening? We just read about them in the newspaper. I don't even know if it's really happening. And are they even really at war? Do they even really care? Or are they coordinating all of this? Is this all just for show? And I think that's the real fundamental question of the global governmental system we're being led into.
We'll talk more about the global governmental system that we're being led into When we return after some commercial announcements, please stay tuned to Financial Survival. I'm Alfred Addisk, and our guest is James Corbett from the Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com.
Provided strength. Indeed, the chemical compounds of thyme contain antioxidants, an effective germicide that kills whooping cough bacteria and makes breathing easier. Just imagine what you can do with thyme herb when it comes to respiratory ailments like croup, pneumonia, asthma, and sinusitis. The extra benefit of thyme herb is that it soothes the nerves and stops spasmodic coughing, so you can get some rest. Who says you don't have time to take care of yourself? Call Apothecary Herbs toll-free for thyme tincture and tea to soothe your cough and get some rest. 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International 704-875-8010 or online at thepowerherbs.com.
Prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
I'm Alfred Addisk. This is Financial Survival, and our guest is James Corbett from the Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. If you're looking for good geopolitical information on the economy and whatever's happening in politics, James is a great source. We're talking about the probability of establishing a new world order, and one of the things you said before we took the break is that you think that the regional competition might be useful, right? They can set up regions and have the Asian region competing against the European region, competing against the North American region, and so on. I'm going to guess that the primary value for that regional competition will be to establish an identity that's not national. You're going to wind up, when you understand that the Asian region is competing against North America, all of a sudden you feel a certain kinship for the Mexicans and the Canadians, right? And the Americans do. Same thing with Europe and wherever, South America and so on. But to me, it seems that we're still going to have to synchronize all of these regions, get them all on the same business cycle. And the only way I can imagine that happening is if they precipitate a global collapse, a global depression, where everybody zeroes out. We all go down into poverty and some sort of collapse, and we sit there for a couple of years, and then someone steps forward from the BIS or wherever and brings the whole world back in sync. Does that make any sense to you, James?
Well, what you're saying does make sense in the sense that there does have to be a global crisis in order to justify that global coordination. And as I say, that's, I think, exactly what we saw, at least in prototype, in 2009 at the April G20 in London. I think that was the first step towards that. But I think that there has to be internal dissension built into the system as a way for the system to operate. So I think eventually they're going to try for the global coordination through the global government that sets everything at the top level. But honestly, I think they have to build a little bit of competition within the system, because that is fundamental to our nature. And whether that's fundamental to human nature or just the way that we have grown up, you know, in our societies, that we expect that, and we need that release valve in a way, so that, for example, when you look even internally in the United States in the political system, they need a left and a right. They need a Republican and a Democrat party, because that is the release valve for the system. You corral people under one flag or another, and you get them to fight with each other so that the system itself always maintains. Those mm-hmm. two competing forces come together to actually prop up the system as a whole. And I think in the same way, that would be the most logical way to start to try to set up a global system, would be to get these regional blocks to compete with each other to prop up the system as a whole. And in that sense, I think you don't need that everyone to be in sync. I think you can have one block trying to raise rates in order to cool off their economy, or to bring in outside investment, or whatever the case may be, at the expense of another. And I think as long as you do have some of the players that are above that system and are seeing the bigger picture, I think that can work towards global goals, just not necessarily in the sense that anybody who's playing that game would really think of it.
How soon do you think we might expect to see something like global government? Not just an idea and a goal. And, you know, in a sense, you could say we've got it now on one mm-hmm. to some degree. But
yeah.
At what point do we finally say, oh, yeah, this is global government. That's what we've got.
Right. Well, okay, yes. So, again, it does depend how you define that and what you're looking for.
Yeah.
But if you mean it in the sense of that we would think of as a global government, I couldn't imagine that coming any sooner than, say, a generation. I think a generation would have to be really steeped into it to bring it there. Unless, I guess, as you say, in the sort of global collapse scenario where there's true, you know, chaos and, you know, Mad Max type of stuff, or nuclear.
We're kind of on the edge of that right now.
We are on the edge. We're always on the edge, I think. I mean, we're always just, a nuclear bomb going off in Dallas or whatever, away from,
not,
you know,
Dallas.
Sorry,
maybe
you said
Fort
Dallas.
Worth,
it was
but
on
not,
your mind.
Not Dallas.
But, you know, Dallas has been mentioned when they throw out some of those cities, you know, when they try to scare them.
No, Dallas doesn't have anything going on here. It's just a big retail shopping center. We don't have any industry. We don't have any, we're not,
don't
no refineries,
yeah.
You know, look at Houston maybe, or wherever.
But the point is taken, right? That we are just one major, massive event away from, you know, the world being changed forever. I mean, imagine a 9/11 on a scale 10 times bigger, and you could imagine that the type of response that would come from that could truly be that catalyzing event that would create the ability for a completely new system to be brought in. But barring that type of cataclysmic event, which again, we can't really predict, but barring that, it would take a generation of indoctrination to really get people to the point where they could accept global government in that sense. But as you say, we already are living through it to a certain extent. And I think if I were one of these, you know, central planner psychopaths at the top that was trying to bring the system into place, I think that would be the much, much better way to do it, rather than to have that kind of, you know, horrible break event that breaks people's psyches and creates the global government all in one go. To do it gradually, as they are doing through the WTO and the IMF and all these hundreds of other things that are creating the spider's web. And people get caught in the spider's web, I think, a lot more easily than they get caught in the bear trap.
I agree with you 100%. Last week we touched on Brave New World in 1984, Brave New World novel by Aldous Huxley, written and published in 1932. 1984, written by George Orwell, published in 1949. And I would say that Brave New World was, they came at you with benefits. They did the things that were logical and rational, and people said, well, that makes sense to me. Sign me up for the spider web. But 1984 was the bear trap. Which one do you think is more dangerous?
I definitely am more afraid of the spider's web than the bear trap, because I think when people get caught in the bear trap and their leg is, you know, caught, it's there, it's immediate. You know that you have to do something. It's life or death. People will saw off their leg to get out of it or whatever they have to do, and there will be a definitive answer one way or another. At the very least, there's the possibility that people will get out of it. But with the spider's web, you don't know about it even, that it, you can't even see it because it's so fine and so small until you're already caught up in it. And even then, it doesn't feel that sense of urgency to get out of it. So it's a nice, soft, you know, cocoon to be mm-hmm. woven into. Perhaps mm-hmm. we're extending the metaphor as far as it can go, but I think the Brave New World Society really is that spider's web, and that's why it is so much more insidious and so much more, in a sense, already here, already real. When you go down the street and you see everyone with their face buried in their smartphone, and everyone's enjoying it. I mean, everyone's getting something out of it. Everyone likes where they are at this point in terms of, you know, the ready access to entertainment and distraction 24/7. It's a very alluring little spider's web to be woven into, and I think we're already, you know, halfway in. What we really need is the wake-up call to say, this isn't a spider's web, but it's a bear trap. You have to saw off your leg. Let's get out of here.
Do you think Aldous Huxley wrote Brave New World as purely a work of fiction, or do you suspect that he was aware of people who were laying the foundation? Back in the 1920s, 1930s, they were already laying the foundation for what we are now coming to call the New World Order. And he knew these were their plans. Was he the mastermind behind the Brave New World, or merely the writer who was echoing the plans that were already in place from first generation of psychopaths?
Well, he was absolutely only the herald of that. He was not the author of it in that sense. And we don't have to speculate about that. We know 100% because he talked about it himself. In 1962, he delivered a famous speech at University of California, Berkeley, called The Ultimate Revolution. You can find it widely available online, in which he specifically talked about the fact that Brave New World was not just something that he was making up. It was stuff that he had accrued from actually seeing the types of experiments that people were working on. To a certain extent, maybe less so before he wrote the novel, but certainly it was confirmed in spades after the novel. And in that 1962 speech, he was talking about experiments that he'd seen in terms of trying to he talked about some animal experiments, like hooking mice's brains up to electrodes that would stimulate certain regions of their brains that would give them a kind of endorphic rush of, you know, elation. And he was talking about those types of technologies that were already being experimented with at that time. And he talked about the human side of those experiments. And Huxley would know, because he does come from a very connected family. People might know his grandfather, T.H. Huxley, as Darwin's bulldog. He was intimately involved with the fight to get Darwin's ideas accepted in the 19th century. And Aldous Huxley's brother, of course, Julian Huxley, was the co-founder of UNESCO, co-founder of the World Wildlife Fund, a very connected insider type of family that did know about these plans. And Huxley apologists will say, yes, he knew about all this and he was warning the people. And that's the way he did frame it, to be fair. He did frame it that way in his interviews that he gave and in the Ultimate Revolution speech. He was warning people about, you know, what dictators of the future could do. But I don't know. I hear a little bit of relish in his voice as he's describing it, because he really did talk quite openly about how the fact we are coming to a scientific phase where people can be made to enjoy their servitude.
Yeah. Dangerous, and still there's a certain kind of logic behind it and the threat of inevitability. We may all be seduced into the New World Order. Not marched at the point of a gun or a bayonet, but seduced, right? And what do you do then?
Yeah. As I say, I think that's the more effective way to do it. And I think we're already halfway there. I think
violence begets violence. And if you're going to have 1984, ultimately you're talking about a police state where someone's running around rapping people on the head or shooting them or whatever. That violence will beget a violent reaction from the public sooner or later. And it's like Nazi Germany. It was a hot show for, I don't know, 15, 20 years. I don't even know if it was that long. Actually, when you think about it, 15 years thereabouts. It looked powerful and omnipotent, and yet what happened? The nation was destroyed. Germany was busted in half, and it's a function of that violence. But on the other hand, if you can run a good seduction, you may be able to get a lot of recruits. We've got only about 2 minutes left, but would you like to? I know you did a video on the Panama Papers, and we don't really have time enough to get into them right now. But are the revelations of corruption? Is this just scandal, or are there real geopolitical implications in the Panama Papers?
Well, there have already been, direct ramifications. For example, the Icelandic prime minister has already stepped down. So that's, the first major thing that's happened as a direct result of this. So there are real revelations here. And I think this is a leak of genuine information. And there are some real, beans that are being spilled. But as always, as with everything else, it's what is being reported and what is not being reported, how it is being reported, what people are focusing on. And like anything else, if you give this information to the bought and controlled corporate mouthpiece media for, corporations and governments, they're going to spin things for the benefit of their paymasters, the corporations and governments. So it shouldn't be surprising that we're finding all of the reporting on this is focusing on the old State Department enemies, Assad and Putin, they're throwing a few sheep to the wolves, the Icelandic prime minister and others. But it's not surprising where the majority of the reporting is focusing on. And I think that's the real story here, is what is being reported to us and what is not. And it's interesting that with this data leak, spilling, whatever, you have 11.5 million documents, of which we have seen, 140 or something like that? There is a lot of data that we do not have access to here.
Well, we're out of time, James. We'll get into the Panama Papers next week. We'll talk a little bit more about them at that time. But we're out of time. I want to thank all of you folks for listening. I'm Alfred Addis here on Financial Survival with our guest, James Corbett, Corbett, from thecorbettreport.com. Take a visit. Thank you, James. Talk to you next week. I'm Alfred Addis. I want to thank all of you for listening, and be back tomorrow. In the meantime, may the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, Frank the producer, and James Corbett. Bye-bye.
I work all night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. There never seems to be a single penny left for me.
That's too bad.
In my dreams, I have a friend. If I got me a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work at all. I'd fool around and have a ball.
Money, money, money. Must be funny.